We made this.
Hi everyone, and welcome to The Time Is Now. Open the pod bay doors, please, Hal. My name is Kurt North, and we are with Andrew Brooker. I don't know whether or not we should assist or arrest this subject, but we'll certainly find out by the time we get to the end of the episode. All right, Brooker, how are you doing, mate?
I'm good, thank you, buddy. I'm good. It's good to be back on talking about Millennium. It's been a little while, and yeah, it was a good excuse to go back and watch some Millennium. How about you, mate? You all right?
Yeah, I'm not too bad. Been busy at work. Got a building project on underway, which is fantastic. We've given 2 weeks, 2 weeks notice, and then 2 weeks to do the bloody job. It's not great.
Sounds like everyone's perfect job.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. So yeah, so I'm still dusting off the bricks and mortar as we speak, sitting down to this podcast. So it's all good. So you mentioned there you were last on last season. So I think it was Blood Relatives. I think from memory, it's episode 8. I think it was.
Yeah, I think it was. Yeah.
Yeah. So. And I know that from the previous five questions that you did, that you were a big fan of the pilot and season one as a whole. So we're almost halfway through season two here, which we'll go and talk about in a few minutes. But what are your thoughts broadly on the pilot up until this point? So now we're halfway through season two and the beginning of season two, and how that all transpires up to this point.
Well, I think broadly speaking, I do like I said, with the previous episode I was on, I talked about how I really like the pilot and the first season as a whole, because it's very dark, it's very horror-centric, which is right in my wheelhouse. So the second season, I think a lot of people forget about the second season of Millennium, because it's not as dark. There's still a lot of strange stuff going on, but it's nowhere near as... There's a lot of grim stuff in the first season.
Yeah.
This time around, this episode as well, like, it has a dark theme to it, but at the same time, somehow, it's still a jolly episode. I don't know.
It starts off with a song.
I know. and this is the kind of TV that only Morgan and Wong can pull off.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think it's a much more light-hearted season. I really like it, and I do think a lot of people forget just how good this season is. And I think a lot of that is because of just how good and how affecting season one is.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think that the season as a whole is my favourite season, probably of TV. It's one of my favourites, closely followed or even just about on par with season three of The X-Files for me, because season three for me of The X-Files is the ultimate. So, I do think that. And as I say, I mean, I've been on quite a lot of season two, and as I say, it is my favourite. But we are here to talk about a particular episode, which is Goodbye Charlie. So Goodbye Charlie was episode 11 of season two, and it was released on the 9th of January 1998. So I was 18 at that point when this came out. So I would have been, yeah, I would have been 18 and coming on 18 when this was released. We would have got it maybe, what, I don't know, 6 months, 12 months later.
Yeah, so would have hit us probably, what, summer 98?
Yeah, summer of 98. So around 18. So this was kind of an interesting story that we get here, and it would have been at a time when I understood things a bit more. So it was an episode that resonates with me from watching season two. It was directed by Kenneth Fink and written by Richard Whiteley. So I think Richard Whiteley had written a few of Space Above and Beyond. So I think he had a Morgan and Wong connection that way.
Okay.
So he has a general connection with that, and you can see probably that in the episode as well, with some of the tropes that they've put in there that obviously Morgan and Wong have stamped into the episode, I would have thought. So what are your first thoughts on this episode then? What do you generally think when you think about Goodbye Charlie?
Like I said earlier, I think it's a weirdly jolly episode. And I don't mean, you know, it's not like Dancing Santa kind of jolly, but it's one of my favourite episodes of the second season, I have to admit. And it is because it has, like I said, got this really dark subject matter that is put across in such a really kind of, I don't know how to describe it. I don't want to say like a nonchalant way, because it's not nonchalant at all. It has a point, and it does get its point across quite well.
Yeah.
But it doesn't hit you over the head with it and then make you feel really bad for watching the episode and enjoying it.
Yeah.
Do you see what I mean? And and I think a lot of that is the singing. You know, Tucker Smallwood's singing is something else.
It's a delight, isn't it? it is an episode. That kind of, I'm the same as you, actually. I was thinking about this today when I was rewatching it just before we came on to talk about it, that it kind of treads ground in a lot of ways, but I kind of like it because I found it difficult to pull this one together, to be honest, when I was looking and back at the episode and making my notes and things. It's full of substance, but at the same time, it hasn't. And I don't know how to express that properly, but it's got really interesting themes that are thought-provoking, and it deserves its own. And some of the themes that they talk about deserves their own podcast in their own right. But it poses a highly emotive, unsolvable question and basically walks out the room.
It really does. It's quite interesting. So, obviously, it's not going to air today. But actually, in the news this morning, they were talking about court rulings and things being put together to talk about like, assisted suicide.
Right. Okay.
Which I genuinely watched and went, what? This. So when this aired, I was 16.
Right.
I don't remember if this was particularly prevalent in the news when I was 16. There must have been something going on for it to be made part of a TV show. That's just how TV shows work.
Yeah, I do have something on that. We'll pick into that during the social media aspect. There's been a question mentioned in there, so I'll delve into that a little bit later. But you're right. There is something that was in 1990 to 1997. There was a particular fella, I can't find the notes at the moment, but there was a particular fella who was in America that was well known and eventually did a 60-minute event show of him assisting someone. So it was high in the news at that point.
This is not going to make for good podcasting. That was the thing HBO done, wasn't it? The TV show with Al Pacino.
It might be. I'm thinking more. I found his name. Dr. Death. He was Jack Kevorkian. It was CBS 60 Minutes. It was broadcast on TV. And that was broadcast, I think we'll say November 1998. So this was, he was well known, but this actually aired the end of 1998 rather than beginning. So it was obviously prevalent in America at that time.
Yeah. But I think what you, misunderstood, but what I think when you say it kind of poses questions, it does. It poses these questions like front and center. What it doesn't do is commit to an answer.
No.
Which is, as a viewer, is frustrating, but as a fan of Millennium, of The X-Files, of Carter, of Morgan and Wong, it's frustrating.
Yeah.
Because, you know, when they have a point or they have something they want, they do ram it home how they feel about it. That's always been the way. So for them to have something this prevalent and this important, personally, I think it's quite an important thing.
Yeah.
And to not tell people what they think is quite strange. I don't blame them for not committing.
Yeah.
Because it's a, you know, it brings up more questions when you do commit to an answer. But I think it kind of leaves you a little unsatisfied because of that.
Yeah. Well, I think that from exactly what I was posing there, the fact that, you know, you could have a podcast just on this subject matter, and we'll get into some of the details as we go through the episode. But it does poses these questions, and I think, you know, if that was happening, if that Dr. Death, the videotapes of Dr. Death were happening around that time, and he was well known, and he served 8 years of a 10 to 25 year sentence, before things started moving in the Supreme Court over there to allow assisted suicide. That the fact that this was prevalent at that point, as you say, I'm not surprised they kind of didn't fall either side of the sword, but it does, as you say, makes it feel like such a unique and weirdly fascinating, but at the same time, not quite sure what to think about it.
Yeah.
So yeah. So if you were to rate it, then you said particularly that you quite enjoyed the episode as a whole, what would you rate it out of 10?
I'd comfortably give it a 7.5. On a good day, probably an 8. I'd probably lean towards 7.5, though, I think.
Right. Okay. I would probably, on a good day, I'd say 7.5, and I would probably average out around a 7. So I think it's a perfectly acceptable episode. I think it poses those questions and it does make you think the more you think about it. And I think that's really important on TV shows.
Yeah.
But and it also has some hallmark, like you say, Tucker Smallwood singing is something that is instilled in my brain and forever will be. Even when you watch the things like Nothing Lasts Forever, the X-File episode with Barbara Beaumont.
Yeah.
That instantly, as soon as she started singing, recalled me back to Goodbye Charlie, which was straight away I was like, I need to watch Goodbye Charlie.
Yeah.
And I think the disappointment in that was I thought it was better than what it actually was.
Yeah.
So I was like, oh, well, never mind.
But nostalgia but yeah, playing a heavy part in that one.
Yeah, absolutely. But yes, but I'd still rate it as a 7. As I say, I mean, 7.5 on a good day, if I'm feeling particularly sort of, you know, good to it, I would give it a 7.5. Have you looked at IMDb? Hopefully you haven't.
I have not.
Okay, so what do you think? Now, bearing in mind, we have only got 211 votes on this one, and Millennium tends to only have about 200 votes, so that kind of skews it in the fact that most of the episodes that are really good have really high ratings, and the ones that are all right, average, tend to have quite low. I mean, there's one in this season, I think it's got a 6.8, so it can fluctuate quite a bit. What do you think this one got?
I would reckon probably closer to your score than mine. I'd say probably a 7.2.
Okay. It actually got a 7.7.
Okay.
Yeah, so it works out. I was looking at it just before. It works out around about 6 episodes from the bottom. But in the episodes that we've seen so far, it's above things like Sense and Anti-Sense. And surprisingly for me, Beware of the Dog.
Okay. That is a surprise.
Yeah, that was the one that kind of jumped out at me. I thought, hang on, no, I think Beware of the Dog's a much better episode. But I think Beware of the Dog's one of those esoteric episodes where you either love it or you hate it or don't understand it. And 1919, so it's around those areas, and there's 3 later on in the season, which it's slightly higher than. So, yeah, so it's 7.7. So it's, yeah, around pretty much between what both of us think, really. So that's
I'd say that was a fair score.
Yeah,
personally, yeah. I know it's a bit higher than you gave it. I would call that fair because the law of averages. You can't have, you know, was it 30? No, 60 episodes of a show.
Yeah.
And all of them be 10 out of 10. You can't.
No,
it's impossible. We've said this a dozen times talking about the X-Files as well.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter how much you love the X-Files. There's 200 plus episodes. They can't all be 10 out of 10 episodes, can they?
Yeah, you do get your crazy cats.
Yeah,
things occasionally, don't you? Yeah. So I think we, because of where we are now, I think we need to dive deeper into the episode. Our opener is clever in the fact that the way it's portrayed is a murder. So the guy's tied up on the bed and he's looking scared while his doctor talks about taking the yellow brick road. So obviously the yellow brick road's being used as the Wizard of Oz kind of an allegory, going to a better place. When you watch it on second watch, you view it very differently to way it's viewed in first. Because I think it plays its cards quite close to his chest as a closed open. Is that how you saw it?
Yeah, absolutely. So I've watched it a couple of times over a couple of days, and it has been a while since I've watched it.
Yeah,
and you kind of forget. And I was like, oh yeah, this is the assisted suicide one. But you do think that, oh, is this a serial killer one? I don't remember. And it does, like, you're right. It does play the cards very close to the chest, and it does. It sets it up like a serial killer thing. It sets it up like a murder, and you're like, well, this is dark.
Yeah,
this is really dark. Because then he starts singing.
Did you not find that made it darker?
For a brief second, it makes it really dark and really creepy.
Yeah.
And then you go, I actually quite like this. Maybe that says more about me than it does about the episode.
Oh, maybe. What did you think of the song choices in the episode as well? The fact that they used the two songs, Seasons in the Sun and Goodbye Charlie. What did you think of the actual choices, the choices of songs?
I don't mind them. Who originally sung Seasons in the Sun?
Oh, now you're asking. It wasn't Westlife.
No, it was not.
So it was Terry Jacks?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I quite like that version of the song.
Yeah.
It's not on a regular playlist of mine or anything, don't get me wrong, but I know the song and I quite like it. And actually, so I quite liked seeing him sing it.
Yeah.
Although this many years later, sadly, the first thing that came to mind was Westlife.
Yeah.
It's awful. I thought the choices were great. It's quite a layered song.
Yeah.
Obviously about, you know, grief and saying goodbye and all of that lot. And I think it's a really good choice. But like you say, it does make it just a shade darker when he first starts singing. And you go, bloody hell, what is he doing?
Yeah, yeah.
But like you say, then you remember and you go, oh, yeah. And I quite like it. It's tough. Like I say, I would have been 16 when this aired, so maybe 18, 19 when I first saw it. There's no way I saw this when it was first on TV.
Yeah.
I don't know how I would have reacted to that, I have to admit. I can't remember that far back.
Yeah, it'd either be one of two ways. Either with absolute frightening and sort of scared out your life, or you'd have probably howled with laughter.
The last is probably more likely,
yeah.
Knowing the kind of stuff I used to watch when I was that age. Yeah. It's a solid cold open. And like I say, because it sets it up as a murder, and because it does feel much more sinister than it actually turns out to be, it is a very well put together cold open.
Yeah, yeah. I do think, as you say, and what we've both said there, is the way that they don't give you enough information to really kind of get your eye around it, but they quickly come back to it, because when we come back out of the cold open, we get the, which is this, I love this bit, the fact that Frank and Lara have quite a distinctive thought on the question of whether or not it was a murder or not.
Yeah.
Intercede that with Gieberhaus's incredible quips that he has through several scenes. I don't know if you recall them as much, too much, but he says things, you know, when they're talking about how you would die and where you would die, he says things like, you know, let me get hit by a freight train, evaporated by a nuclear blast or a massive coronary.
Yeah.
After the final touchdown when the Hawks win the Super Bowl. And then when Lara says something like, you know, I'd like to be poetic going down Niagara Falls, he quips in with my luck, I'd survive the fall. I'd lie in pain with the prairie dogs run over me.
Yeah.
But what did you think about the stances that Frank, Lara and Gieberhaus were putting above the fact that you have Preston, who's the guy that's died, and the way that they're kind of setting their stalls up to which opinion they have of the idea of assisted suicide, or whether or not it was a murder?
I quite like it. I think less of a point of view of the characters as to what they'd like to happen to them. I like, it's just those are the conversations you would have at work if you're dealing with that kind of stuff day in, day out.
They're
the kind of conversations I have at work myself, and I don't deal with that day in, day out. It's just when you spend hours on end with the same people, conversations go in that direction sometimes.
Yeah.
But it is one of my favourite things about Frank as a character, is that he's just him, and that he just, you know, he talks to people like he's friends and he's working with them, because he is. They're colleagues, whether or not they're, you know, over a dead body. I do think the quips are funny.
Yeah.
The Hawks winning the Super Bowl made me smile. The Prairie Dogs bit made me laugh.
Yeah, I mean, you change that to looking back at season one and just, you know, I think Gieberhaus has something, he says something in the pilot, which is just a one-off quip, which is about the only joke in the whole entire, not the whole entire season one, but it's jokes a few and far between in season one, where this one, yeah, you're getting, you know, at least three or four in the space of 20 seconds, really.
Yeah, but this is kind of what I mean when I say this season gets much more lighthearted. I don't know. Maybe it was direction from Fox. Please stop trying to depress our audience.
Yeah.
I don't know, but there was something about the whole second season. It let up a little bit, and I don't think it helped or hurt it badly in either direction. It was just a different season of television. But yeah, but you get that lightheartedness, and with the four or five jokes in the space of 20 seconds, like you say, it's more jokes in that one 20-second slot than you get in the entirety of the first season.
Yeah, absolutely. What did you think of Lara? Because this is the third episode of Frank and Lara being together. I opened up with Open the Pod Bay Doors piece, Hal, because this is the first time that we hear that.
Yeah.
So obviously we've seen Lara in, I think it was 1919. Yeah, it was 1919. And we saw her in Monster.
Yeah.
But this, in Monster, it was kind of like more of an introductory thing. We've had a little few bits of scenes with her there. In 1919, she comes quite late into the episode, but is quite important in developing the case. This one, it kind of feels more, and I don't want to say X-Files, but more like an X-File in the way that she's in there from the beginning. And they have quite a few conversations over the course of the episode. So I'm thinking of scenes like in the hospital when they're talking about the degradedness of how, and that's where Frank had Jordan, and scenes where they're generally talking to each other about, and at the Jeep as well, when they're looking outside of the, they're looking outside the window of the kind of the Samaritan type home. Yeah. Some of these conversations feel quite natural. is that how you felt with that? And do you think it's developed quite well from there?
Yeah, I think that's it. I think the developed is the perfect word for it, because they have. You've had, like you say, a couple of episodes with a couple of scenes together, but here they're forced, if you like. They're not forced to work together. They just happen to be working together this time, and this time they know each other.
Mm.
So because they know each other, and because they've had a few, they've worked together for a bit, it's they've been written in such a way that they would be comfortable at this point, you know. Maybe not sharing really, really intimate details, but like the same as you would for anybody you've worked with for a few days. You talk about football and life and what have you. You get friendly. So that rapport kind of, it kicks in naturally. And I think what makes it so good is that the writing has put that in, and the people involved have acted it perfectly. So they have acted like they just get on, you know. They're not necessarily at opposite ends of any spectrum. They just sat next to each other in the car and chatting.
Yeah.
I like that. It's one of my favourite things about most procedural TV that works for me because I'm convinced that these people work together and they're friendly.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it makes it much easier to watch.
I actually think over the two or three episodes that I've been, two or three times, shall I say, over the last couple of days of watching this episode, I think I did a rewatch. I would say now it's almost a year and a half ago, but I basically sped through them all because it was, I literally was like one after the other, especially season two. I kind of rattled through them, but I didn't give them time to breathe. And because I've been going through them a bit slower on this time, that I'm finding things that I wouldn't necessarily have found. Now, this one, as I say, what I found was it did feel natural. It did feel like the actors were natural with each other. You've got two fantastic actors in Lance and Kristen. They work really well together. And I think that this is probably there may well be episodes later on where I think they've got really good connections here. But I think this is probably the most honest acting that I've seen them both do.
Yeah.
As a duo between investigating a case, really, I think they've done really well, and even like aspects of outside the Jeep, they start joking with each other and start almost doing the Tempest Fugit and Max in X-Files, where Mulder says I'd go with you, Scully, but I'm afraid they'll keep me in with the mental hospital, and Scully says I so do I. And I think on this one she says something on the lines of like, just say you're depressed, and he went, I'm not depressed, I'm just quiet. So there's those elements. It feels like it's earned, and it feels like there's a natural element to them, and I can't think of anything further down the line where it feels that earnest, really. We do get to another scene as well coming. We kind of get into Stephen's job and what he's doing, the fact he's a Samaritan and or whatever that may be. I didn't jot down what his actual job role there was, but he's kind of like a Samaritan and a care worker, and he's taking phone calls and trying to help people. And he receives a phone call from the bar, and he traces the call back, and he seems to react to it. So there's a hint that Kylie, and I think it was her name was Eleanor, who we later find out, you know, when he basically sees her. But he seems to react to that call, even though it was ever so brief, as almost as a hint that he has a gift, or that he's, as he later talks about hitting that mystical plane that both Frank and Lara have in different ways. What did you think to that element of the episode? It was subtly played, and Lara does give an explanation later on in the episode that could be just a standard answer to it. But how did you think that played throughout the episode?
Yeah, I think it played okay. But I think, again, the other issues with this episode, it does feel kind of non-committal.
Mm.
Because you're right. When you see him on the phone, and he's almost like his face changes. He's like, oh yeah, I can feel this one.
You know? Yeah.
But great. Explain it or don't, but don't hint at it.
Yeah.
I like the idea that maybe he can feel that there's a thing, or just not even necessarily. It doesn't even need to be like a magic or a power or anything, you know. But
yeah.
You know, but just explain that, I don't know, through 30 years of working at the other end of the phone at the Salvation Army, he knows that, you know, this particular person is very ill.
Yeah.
It does cause a problem when he starts listing symptoms. That's a problem. But I quite like the idea that he is just an average Joe trying to help, as opposed to being some kind of magic guy.
We do get, and it's only what Lara thinks, that she poses the question, doesn't she, about like sort of packs of dogs that feel stuff, and
yeah,
and there's that element to it. But you're right, with if they're going down that route, and they're going down the ambiguous route, why then have a scene where he's diagnosing someone who thinks she's already got a lump and hasn't told anyone?
Yeah.
You know, where is in the episode's first death, this is the next question I'm going to bring up, actually it works out quite well, but he felt ashamed and hid the disease, but he knew he had it, and he knew that he didn't have enough medical insurance and couldn't seek medical treatment for it, and hid it from his friends. But that was a way in, because he only told his one-time doctor, and that was the way in of finding out Kylie could potentially find that out. But yeah, with, as you say, with that other one, it seems like he's sensing that, and it's almost like Leonard Betts in X-Files, where he says, you have something I need. Yeah, you know, so it's that element, and you're right, it doesn't commit to the episode at all. It just kind of like leaves it lingering, and, you know, gives half answer. And I think that is a problem for me. With regards to that episode. So, as I was mentioning there, I think there's a number of things that this episode is trying to talk about. And assisted suicide is the obvious one that they're going to. But there's a few elements that they talk about. And when we get the medical examination of Preston Williams, who is the first, who was the first death, we find out that the cause of death was the coronary. But we also find out that he had things like secondary diabetes, gangrene, in the gallbladder, and he sought medical treatment, but he was lacking health insurance. Now, did you think that was particularly aimed? I know we're both British, but that was particularly aimed at that time, at the American kind of system.
Absolutely. And it's one of those moments where it happens in TV occasionally. Films, it tends to happen a bit more in. But you look at a TV episode and go, that is just as poignant now as it was 20 years ago when they first done it.
Yeah.
And I think that can definitely be said for that episode. But yeah, I think it is definitely it's a dig, and it's a not very subtle dig either.
Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty direct, isn't it?
It is, yeah. They're not messing around going, yeah, we could have helped this person, but we refused to because money.
Mm. Yeah, because I think he, when we get there, Stephen Kiley talks about the fact that, you know, they have money talks, really. The fact that it's not about saving lives, it's about money for the doctors. And again, that kind of re-emphasises what they were saying, what Lara and Frank were saying in that room. I'm jumping around a little bit, but I just wanted to mention this because I thought this was quite funny. That Frank, when I mentioned about the fact that it was very kind of like Tempest Fugit and Max with the comments that Lara and Frank were throwing about.
Yeah.
That was a scene where they were both going to contact that group. Lara on the phone and Frank was going to go in and he says, you know, act depressed. Or she says, act depressed. And he says, I'm just quiet. And then he sees Stephen Kiley and gets taken over to Russ. And he sits down with Russ and he says, what's wrong? And Frank basically says, my wife and I are separated and my daughter's living with her. I have these nightmarish visions that are the manifestation of pure evil. And if that's not a tagline for the millennium, I don't know
well,
what
it
is.
Yeah, it really is, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. So I thought that was quite nicely done for, you know, halfway through the second season. Effectively, that's the synopsis of the show, where we are, which was great. At that point, we find out that Stephen Kiley is. Frank eventually finds that out because there's the whole scene in the church as well. What did you think of the scene in the church just before we move on from there?
I'll be honest, I'd call it quite forgettable, mainly because I've forgotten most of it.
Right, okay. So it's another suspected assisted suicide or murder.
Yeah.
That's already happened before the beginning of this episode. They go to that funeral and then the son comes up to them and says, you know, she died. It wasn't anything. I need you to leave right now. And then that's when they see the flowers, which was Dr. Stephen Kiley. So it's plumped in. You're right. It's fairly forgettable, even to the point that I almost forgot to mention it.
And it's interesting as well, because like the conversation at this point about like assisted suicide, etc., etc., it carries on with Frank, doesn't it? So like he, and they make quite a point of this. Like the clearest bit of dialogue that he has is, "I just want to go before my daughter."
Yes, that's in the church. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Now that is a very committed stance to have, and I think it's a committed stance of pretty much anybody that's got kids.
Yeah.
Has. So I'm not particularly commending them for having it, because that's no one disagrees with that. But I do find it quite interesting that that's the clearest bit of his dialogue in the entire section, and it's that one sentence.
Yeah,
and it continues on from their conversation previously.
Yeah, and that's what I was saying at the beginning of the episode as well. The fact that it doesn't seem to go anywhere. It's like the same conversations are happening time and time again, with a little bit sprinkled on top every time.
Yeah,
and it doesn't seem to have any traction, and it's difficult to remember where things happen when. Not necessarily where things happen when, but kind of, you know, if I was thinking about this 3 or 4 days later, not from now, I would struggle to remember which bits were where, because it's kind of the same argument or the same questions every time. But what's really interesting when we move on from that, jump back in to where they were talking about Samaritans, and Frank finds out where Dr. Kiley actually works secondary. We get a scene in the lift with the dead body. What were your thoughts on that? He starts to mention things like Stephen Hawking and the fact that, you know, that he had everything and the guy that died in anonymity and things like that. What did you think of that scene?
I don't think it adds much to the episode as a whole, but like you say, because of the way the episode is done, and it is a lot of the repeated stuff over and over again, it's and a lot of it is very, like I say, non-committal. Nothing that really happens after, you know, between cold open and the final scene in the house, nothing really happens in that time. And I think that's it, that's that and the church, the epitome of that. So it's just there to fill 5 minutes of airtime.
The only thing I would say, and this moves into when we get to the interrogation scene, is that he starts talking about Stephen Hawking. I'm not quite sure where they were going with this, because that's like thrown in as if it's like, right, there's a point to this. And the only thing I can kind of surmise from it is that he's saying that he wants to be that he himself is reflecting on himself, that he wants to be the man who sustains life, but he's the man who ends up ending it. Either way, he wanted a purpose. So when we start talking about the interrogation scene, and within this element, he starts talking about God never came to you. It's almost as if he's like angry at God because God's not doing stuff to help these people. But the trichotomy comedy, or whatever you call it. Yeah, the hole in the neck.
I can't say it. Tracheotomy.
Tracheotomy, yeah. The tracheotomy. It seems to be the profound moment that he switches. So the idea that while he was a doctor, he was kind of this person who wanted to sustain life for so long. But he was an underachiever. He tried to do this for so many different ways, and he was always considered as someone who wasn't quite the big man to be able to do it, and wasn't this saviour. Yet now he's blaming God on that because God wouldn't come for people who are terminally ill. That's the only way I can see that he's trying to own a purpose.
But the problem is, it just seems, again, it's unsatisfactory in where it goes. It's just another thread just kind of left there.
Mm.
I would commend them a bit more, I think, if the episode was... I'm being very negative about a lot of this episode. I really like it. I honestly, I do.
And I'm the same, but this is what I said. Again, goes back to the beginning. It's got a lot in it, but it's got nothing in it.
Yeah.
It's just really strange.
I quite like the idea of... and it's something we see in a lot of TV, medical TV especially. It's like you have a doctor who loses faith, I suppose is one word, loses the need to do it because he's just seen so much horrible shit and seen so many people suffering, or, you know, whatever the reason, and which is similar to his reasons here, that all these terminally ill people that are just left to suffer because, you know, we're not allowed to help them, or God won't come and hurry up and take them, or all of these legitimate reasons to watch a guy go out of his mind and start doing stuff like this on his own.
Mm.
But we don't really see any of that.
No.
Yeah, or we don't see enough of it to really believe that's why he's doing it.
Because you've only got to look at, again, the fact that when they go into the hospital and they see the two bodies, and the fact that that's when he switched.
Yeah.
And then we get a bit of a conversation in the interrogation about how he sees that, you know, I don't know anyone alive by that name. And then Laura goes, do you know anyone dead by that name? I don't see it as being dead. I just see it as elsewhere. It then throws another element in of the plane, and kind of like, is he like a Frank and a Laura, but a different type of person, which comes out of nowhere as well. I don't know what you think about that.
I don't think I'd ever thought about it like that, to be honest.
Yeah, that's the way that I saw it. The fact that at that point when she looked at his eyes and he saw back at it, that they start to talk about a plane, and then they start intimating that there's this element of the Millennium Group being involved.
Yeah.
In a way, it's kind of like, you know, this is why you're here kind of thing, which they do it gets quite tropey with that, with like, so Beware of the Dog, when it goes to the old man, and Monster, where they get sent to there, and then this one, they seem to just know all these things.
Yeah.
And I think
it's another one of them that they need out of the way.
Yeah, exactly. It's just, it's either out of the way or they're doing it for a particular reason. And he mentions this plane thing, and that comes out of nowhere, but it's only hinted at, and it's not really, even to the point where you didn't even notice it.
Yeah.
So, it's kind of like, it throws that into the mix on top of everything else. And it feels like it should be quite poignant, and it isn't. So, so I'm not quite sure. And then you get the whole Bobby Darin, Morgan and one conversation as well. How did you think that worked within the episode itself? Because there is a reason why they used that Bobby Darin story. But the second one, the fact that they're using this Bobby Darin element right through season two.
I think it worked okay. I maybe don't think this was the best episode to use it in, but mainly because the rest of the episode is not particularly... it's not really... Okay, so it has the sections, like you said, where the Millennium Group have kind of sent these guys, Frank and Whatsface, to him.
Mm.
But outside of that, it doesn't feel like a lore-filled episode. Just to bring other elements from season two into it as well, I don't think it's required, really. I mean, do you say that you reckon there's another reason for it?
No, I mean, I'm just thinking, well, the Bobby Darin conversation itself, if we're talking about the Millennium Law bit, which was more the getting to the plane and things, they could have made a big thing about that. They could have actually, it could have been like another, you know, we have this element, you know, we know that you have this, you can see angels, because we've had Midnight of the Century already.
Yeah.
We've had Curse of Frank Black. You know, we've had these elements of the visions and everything kind of coming to the fore. We're halfway through the season, so you could have made a big element of that, but they didn't. They kind of kept it kind of just low key and intimated it more than anything else. But the Bob and Darren conversation was more about the fact that when he was up to 16, that he had that change where he stopped taking his meds, and because of that, you got Mac the Knife and all those songs where you might not have got that. And I think that that's reflecting on what Stephen Kiley's trying to do, the fact that he's made this change and he's relating that to Bobby Darin. But then why would Bobby Darin be involved and then all of a sudden Frank Black is a main star? You know what I mean? It's kind of like,
yeah.
Where does that all come from? And was it worth putting that in? And I think it actually makes quite an interesting story because it gives Stephen Kiley and Frank a connection. I just think they could have made more of it.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, I get what you mean now. Yeah, you're right. We could have had a little bit more, and it would have been nice to have some more. But, yeah, it's another part of the episode that's just it's not – it doesn't go anywhere. Dude, too much of this episode just halts the story.
We've got to get to the end of the episode and go, well, if I'm talking about this episode, then I'm giving it a 4. If I'm not thinking about talking about this episode, we give it a 7.
Yeah, it is one of those episodes where we go, this is really fun. And I love this episode. But yeah. You know, if you overthink it too much, it is kind of pants.
Yeah. All right. Okay. We'll move on to the next sort of question, which is probably the same as the previous 12. So Lara starts talking about the fact that is he right? Because he's aware that they're going to have years of pain, but Frank says, you know, if you haven't got the choice themselves, then it's murder. And I think that again is kind of getting at the fact that, you know, do families or whoever who may not have had the right to end someone's life because of the care that they're in, do we have the right to end their lives if they don't know about it? I think that's what they're trying to get at. I think,
yeah,
because
so that's a really interesting direction it takes. I remember quite a while ago, this is kind of like a side thing. So I remember having a conversation with someone much, much smarter than me about assisted suicide.
Mm.
And they mentioned not falling on the side of legalizing, not refusing to fall on the side of legalizing it because they didn't believe in it.
Yeah.
But refusing but not wanting it legalized because actually one of the worst things that could happen if you did that was that people could feel compelled to do it to not be a burden. And when you start thinking about shit like that,
yeah,
then it gets really dark. And I think that's kind of where she's going
with it
in this episode. And that's the first thing that came to mind when she said it. I was like, oh, but yeah. And a literal unanswerable question.
Yeah, and I think you mentioned, and I'll talk about this a bit later on. You mentioned that this morning we've got court cases and stuff in England because we don't have the assisted suicide. You can get up to, I think, 14 years.
Yeah,
for doing it. And I know that we've had court cases where people have gone to Sweden and I think a husband came back. This is just off memory. I haven't read into this, but I think he came back and potentially got arrested for it.
Yeah,
and I think that she wrote something about stuff, but the fact that you still have that element within English law. Now, I'm of the same opinion as what you've just said there, that it's like it's open to abuse, and it's one of those things where can we get to a point where it isn't open to abuse, and can you honestly say that that wouldn't happen? And I don't think you can say that. Whereas you look at America, we're not right to talk about Americans, but they do have, in certain states, they do have the assisted physician's assistant suicide. Some are by court, some are by physicians, and depending on what the actual level of whatever it is available, then they will do it. And I don't know what that element would be and what the threshold is for different groups, but it's such a touchy subject, and that comes to when the comment is made, sort of obeying immoral laws is the end of the world, which is a pretty heavy statement.
Yeah, it really is.
Yeah, and so having those elements, which again I praise the episode for, but it doesn't really jump on either side. But I get why, because it's such a dodgy subject, because there's so many grey areas that you can't really go into,
and it kind of dares you to want to talk about it, but yeah. doesn't want to get in on the conversation itself.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is literally like pulling a pin, throwing a grenade and running.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And I do appreciate that part of the episode. I do, because that's what it's designed to do in a lot of ways. Yeah. It's just, I don't think it knows what it wants to do.
No.
Properly, because as you said, it's throwing elements in at different parts of the episode and it doesn't really fill them out on any of them. I think we're kind of getting towards the end of this now. So the end of the episode has the fact that they can't charge him on anything and he gets released, and then there's basically a chase. So we are up to this point where, as you said before, we start at the very beginning and there's a lot of stuff that happens, and then we get to the end with the kind of the group, and we find out, because obviously the motel woman has been part of the group and she's the one that's been helping him with the motel, which is why it's the same motel every time.
Yeah.
We also have the picture of the, what did you think about the inclusion of the pictures and the walnut and the grease prophecies and things? Do you think that was
that was strange? And yeah. I can't claim to be any kind of philosopher on Greek myth.
Yeah.
But that sounds strange even to me, and I'm willing to believe a lot.
Yeah.
It just didn't seem to fit. It seemed a weird, again, another element that maybe should have gone somewhere else.
Yeah.
Were they just afraid to put pennies in eyeballs? You know, make it really obvious?
Yeah. Yeah.
I have no opinion on it because I don't think they have much of an opinion on it.
I think they had the word prophecy in it, so they went, we'll go with that.
Yeah, that'll do.
That'll do. We'll have a weird painting. And then Lara says some random stuff about the fact that I've seen a lot of things. I've been to Rome, I've been here, I've been there, and I've never seen anything quite like that. I was like, okay, whatever. Because they made a big thing of Frank looking at the picture as well at the beginning.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, okay. But what did you think of the final scenes leading up to the mass suicide, effectively? What did you think of that final scene before we get to the very, very end?
So do you mean like the lead up to the...
The lead up to the post-it note, yeah.
So it's the him singing again.
Yeah, yeah, going, yeah, right up the whole scene up until you know, we have the suicide, him singing with them, the fact he uses the poems, he's explaining stuff and how people have died and you know, Marines have gone, you know, crying, but then nurses or someone else has gone really quiet up until the point of the post-it note, because I want to talk about the post-it note at the very end, separately.
I really like it. I think it's an amazing scene. It's a very touching scene.
Mm.
And it feels out of place in the rest of the episode, in as much as a lot of care and attention has gone into this scene.
Mm.
In the writing, like you say, the instantly he's explained why they're taped down.
Yeah.
You know, because they said they want to do it, they've committed to it, but, you know, the suicide bomber thing, you know, just because you said you're going to do it, when it comes to the moment, will you be able to?
Do you need to push yourself over the edge to, yeah.
So I'll be there to help. And I think it's dark and chilling, but nice.
Yeah.
And it's quite... I like that he has a group of people and he hasn't had to help them all, which I think is good. So some of them are there, have done it by choice. It won't ever look like that because they're all rigor taped up, but they've done it by choice. And now we know that they've done it by choice. And for that, I very, very much like this scene.
But going back to the very beginning, Frank is like, it's murder, it's murder, it's murder, it's murder.
Yeah. Lara's, and you're sitting there going, well, actually, for once, Frank, you're wrong.
Mm.
But you're wrong for the best reason.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, so yeah, I agree. I think that the way that it was done, the way that it was tied in with the motel, and I didn't, for the first couple of times, didn't factor in who that woman was until I went, oh, hang on.
Yeah.
It's clicked now that she's the one that goes to the group sessions, and she's the motel owner, and she's the one that's, like, pushing him into the right rooms and making sure that everything's in place, including the paintings and stuff.
Yeah.
I didn't click on that for a while. And I always wondered, it was a bit odd that he was like looking at her particularly, sort of with affection. But it all makes sense on my last couple of viewings. And as you say, I think that the fact that they make the choice themselves, and it's only the ones that need that little help over the edge. And some of the ways that he described, like, the poem and things like that, did you think that that was a way of manipulating them at all, or did you feel it was just him talking? Because that was...
I think it was him trying to calm them. I do think there was an element of manipulation in there, which, you know, maybe in a more poignant episode would have been a point for discussion.
Yeah.
I think. But here it's just... You have to want to see that it's manipulation, I think.
Yeah.
So I do kind of... I like to see it. It's just him kind of calming them down. Because what you don't get, which obviously would make the episode a whole different thing, is you don't get anybody suddenly going, you know, shaking their head, going, no, don't do it, and him doing it anyway.
Yeah.
Because then true. It really is murder.
Yeah. Yeah, that's very true. Yeah.
So... So when you get that moment where there's a couple that he's got to help, they're accepting of the help.
Yeah.
So I like to look at it and go, well, he's calming them down. And he's letting them know it's going to be all right. And I think that I don't want to say that I would be in the same position, because that would be a horrible thought to have.
Yeah.
But I don't think I could press that button on my own.
No, I don't think I could either, to be honest. It's definitely not, I don't think it's within me. Okay. So the voicemail as well. What did you think to the voicemail, the little voicemail that she left? Do you remember it?
Yeah. I'm not going to be here ever again.
Yeah. So
I think I had the same reaction he did when he heard it. He's a cheeky git.
Yeah. Yeah, it was it was poignant, but also I think it also gives us that bit of urgency, doesn't it? The fact that, you know, we know that Frank's now on the way, and
yeah,
you know, they do this the car speeding around the corner and stuff, which is quite tropey. But yeah, you know, I don't mind the Jeep going around at that fast; it's all good. And then we get there. Lara starts talking about we've got a suspect out there. Describes who he is, and then we also have the kind of element that we walk up to the post-it note, and the post-it note says it wasn't his choice, or yeah, it wasn't my choice.
Yeah.
And then we see the randomest thing in the world ever, that we see him in the painting. So what were your first initial thoughts when you saw that scene?
It's completely bizarre, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's completely bizarre. And it's another part of this bloody episode. Do you go, does he think he's a prophet? Does he think he's sent by God? Because if he was sent by God, he wouldn't be worrying about the terminal people in the hospital when he was a doctor.
Yeah.
I don't understand.
I don't understand. And has he entered the painting? Has he drawn a painting of himself? Has he disappeared? Where is he? How is he? What is he doing? You know, is he committing suicide? It's like, I don't know what's happening.
Mate, if they'd closed on the painting and the thing had winked at you before the screen went black, it wouldn't have surprised me one little bit.
I can imagine that. Oh, man. Okay. Right, okay. So before we get into the social media element, what are your final thoughts on this episode now that we've gone through it?
I still love it.
Yeah.
I still love it. It's such a fun episode. Like I said before, not up there with the best of them, but I really like it. But yeah, not one to be picked apart, I don't think.
No.
If you overthink it, you're gonna ruin this episode quite quickly, like we have.
Yeah, exactly. So we'll quickly forget about it. Right. Okay. So we just need to jump into the social media element. So let's go and have a listen there. Look at the mailbag for this episode. Goodbye, Charlie. Right. So on Twitter, we've got at Frank Black Jr. Let's see what he says. He says, an interesting episode, took a small word, is awesome. I think it was a smart way to introduce such a complex theme like euthanasia to the show and to TV. The ambiguity of character, evil, good, human, whatever, was pretty cool. And Lance and Kristen were great together. So we mentioned Lance and Kristen being really good as a partnership together. The fact that they opened the question, what did you think of the real kind of question that the Frank puts out there right at the very end, when he says, is he from heaven or hell? How did you think that was a bit overused and a bit of a thump hammer, or did you think it was just targeted just right?
I think it was a bit much.
Mm.
I think it was a bit much. I don't think, I mean, mate, because it isn't, doesn't he say, because that's what the group are asking, is he from heaven or is he from hell?
Because they ask him, do we arrest or assist him? And they say that's not the question they're asking. They're asking, is he from heaven or hell?
Maybe that is what the group's asking. I don't think... I think it's a bit heavy-handed. I think it's a bit much. It's not required at all. I think he's just a guy who feels a little bit too much.
Yeah, absolutely. And Tucker Smallwood, he says Tucker Smallwood was awesome. I would agree with that. Do you have anything of particular note from Tucker? I mean, obviously he played in Home on the X-Files, and he's a well-known character around the things like Space Above and Beyond as well, and beyond that as well. So what do you think of Tucker Smallwood?
Oh, he is the standout in this episode.
Yeah.
There's no two ways about that. I think he's absolutely brilliant. Let's say the singing's great. So he turns up in everything. He's one of those guys that still turns up in a lot of TV. I think he turned up in Will and Grace this season.
Right, okay.
Yeah. Which is completely bizarre. I didn't expect to see him in that at all. It's him.
Yeah. He turns up in things like Star Trek and all kinds, doesn't he? So, yeah, he's someone that appears in a lot.
I really like him. I think he's brilliant. He is the best bit of this episode. Yeah. As much as I love Frank, I think he is the standout.
Yeah.
Goodbye, Charlie.
So I think that if you were to put... I think Darren Mooney mentions this, that this is the first kind of serial killer of the week. And then we get Mikado in a couple of episodes later. But it's the first serial killer of the week where it's not an average white man as well.
Yeah.
So I think that element would help. Do you think that this would have had as much of an effect with, one, a lesser actor, and two, a white actor on top of that?
I mean, a lesser actor, no. Mm. You need someone of his... Is it too much to say of his calibre?
No,
because
I think
Tucker Smallwood is a fantastic actor.
Yeah.
I think he's brilliant. I don't think it makes a difference. I don't think his skin colour makes a difference. It's not referenced in the episode.
No, I suppose it isn't. No, I think it's only, it's only the Greek thing, isn't it? But it's not, there's nothing from that aspect of it. I think just purely because it's our first Millennium episode where we actually have a black person, as your kind of your main, antagonist, really. And you know, he's, as you say, he's such a great actor that, you know, he's worthy of all the praise. And I think that without him, you're right. I think without him, I think it would have been a much harder episode to love as much as we love it. Right. Okay. So Michael Little says, this was on Facebook. So he says, this is one of my favorites. It is well written, and I'm not sure what to think about the Angel of Death, or is it Mercy? Great performance by Tucker. It almost feels like an episode X-Files, but in a good way. So what do you think of the comparison to the X-Files then?
I think if we were reviewing this as an X-Files episode, I think we'd be far more... I don't think we'd be as lenient on it for being, you know, for not committing to any of the feelings or just knowing that people are ill or the winking painting. I think we'd expect it. You know, it's
I mentioned Leonard Betts, for example. It would be, do you think it would go down more that route if they pushed the X-Files slant on it, that he recognizes that they are ill and he goes for them for that reason?
Yeah, I think it would. Yeah, I think it would. It would have to be something you'd have to explain that they know.
Yeah,
we would be far less forgiving of Mulder and Scully just going, "Oh yeah, he did it just 'cause." You know,
yeah.
We did. We wouldn't accept it, and X-Files fans wouldn't accept it. That's not to say Millennium fans do.
Yeah,
obviously there's a massive crossover, but we're much more forgiving of it as a Millennium episode. As an X-Files episode, I think it would have worked, but it would have needed much more explanation. Would have probably needed to be a slightly tighter written episode.
Yeah,
and the X-Files.
It kind of, you mentioned this before, it kind of falls in the cracks a little bit, doesn't it? It's like an X-Files episode. It's not quite a Millennium episode. It has Millennium elements in it. It has the Millennium kind of aspect. You know, Millennium goes through things like the well-worn lock and, you know, episodes like The Wild and the Innocent, for example, where they talk about abuse and child abuse and things like that. And this is another factor. This is kind of opening up a question almost to a Star Trek level of like, what is this is a real life issue how do you deal with it kind of thing. And I don't, X-Files has that in some elements, but
yeah, I don't think X-Files could have gotten away with it quite as well. It wasn't, X-Files, like all TV does, X-Files brought in of the time subject matter.
Yeah.
It had to stay relevant. All TV shows have to do that.
Yeah.
But I don't think it could have gotten away with just putting euthanasia up there on the screen and going, what do you think? I don't think...
Yeah.
It wouldn't have worked for the X-Files, for one. Yeah. It's not the kind of tone that the X-Files would set. It does work in a much darker, more thought-provoking tone that Millennium tries to build.
We get to Frank O'Donnell. Frank O'Donnell says that he talks about assisted suicide was a big subject of debate back in that time. No social media, so it was big news. It was in the news quite a bit, mostly with negative point of view being favoured, religious implications and all, which that's quite an interesting element that, you know, we could spend, you know, we'd have to research it for a start off, but we'd spend hours and hours talking about that, I would have thought. And for some reason, Bobby Darin's became huge again for about a year.
Yeah.
Which is so that's quite an interesting comment. But what I was talking about before was that we have the Dr. Death thing. That was around 1997. He ended up spending quite a bit of time in prison because of it. And then in June 97, the US Supreme Court rules said that banning physician-assisted suicide did not violate the Constitution, and that was against the case for Washington versus Glucksberg. And the court left the matter of with the Constitution of a right to physician's aid to dying to the states themselves. So that opened up all the states to do whatever. So in October of 1997, Oregon's Death with Dignity Act became law, and that was passed. There was various other elements, you know, the U.S. district judge tried to issue injunctions against it and ruled it unconstitutional. So there's this big battle going on between them. And as I say, in 1998, the pathologist and assisted suicide advocate Jack Kerkovian, known as Dr. Death, videotapes the death of Thomas York. He submitted that to CBS for 60 Minutes, and it was broadcast on television. So that was all happening around this time of when this episode aired. So that's a bit of background on that. Moving forward to where we are right now, I saw something on Sky News in the UK recently. It was a guy called Phil Newby. He's a father of 48. He's got motor neuron disease. And he was saying things like, similar to what you said about your friend, you know, saying there needs to be safeguards in place. You know, vulnerable people can be taken advantage of the law, but people deserve the right to choose. And just because equipment can keep people alive, it doesn't mean that it should. These are things that he was saying on the news channel, which was happening literally as I was watching an episode on my phone. It came on Sky News, so I'll watch that for a little bit. And even, I don't know if you watched Designated Survivor, but Designated Survivor had an assisted suicide episode very recently in season three.
No, I didn't watch it, no.
So it is relevant in, as you mentioned before, I mean, that was back in 1998, 97, and, you know, we're talking 2019 when we're recording this, and it's still relevant to this day. So there is a lot of discussion to be had. It's not a forum on here to talk about them, but there is that element. I mean, do you think that, just in broad terms, you know, the fact that it has that overarching feeling and prowess and I don't know what the best words are, but kind of it's so relevant to how we live as human beings that, you know, it is open for debate and, you know, it should be debated more. And what are your general thoughts on it?
Oh, for sure. I do think it's something that should be debated. I think it's something that we shouldn't be scared of. And I think this is the biggest issue when it comes to a lot of stuff like this. Without wanting to get political, it doesn't matter if it's this or abortion or same-sex marriage or anything like that. People are scared of it. People are scared of change. People try and bury it.
Yeah.
That's just how it works. And I think we live in a time where we shouldn't do that, because by doing that, all you do is just you create a bigger divide.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely.
I don't want to be arguing with co-workers about Brexit and abortion and assisted suicide. I want to talk to them about the film I watched last night.
Yeah,
you know,
it would be nice not to talk about Brexit for a little bit.
Oh, wouldn't it just?
just for one day. You know, it'd be nice. But that's the world that we're currently living in. So when this episode airs, God knows where we'll be. So we'll still be talking about Brexit, no doubt. But thank you for joining me, Brooker. It's been a fantastic episode. You know, we've enjoyed talking about the same thing over and over again.
For what it's worth,
yes.
the film I was talking about is called You Don't Know Jack,
right?
And it's an HBO film from 2010. Playing Jack Kevorkian. Is that his name?
That's his name. Yeah.
Okay. I remember watching it when it aired and going in with absolutely no knowledge of the subject matter at all, and it was brilliant, and pretty thought provoking as well, if I remember rightly. So if you find it on TV somewhere, worth a watch. It's actually very good.
Right. Oh, brilliant. Well, that's good that it was the, as you were saying, the Al Pacino type thing then? Yeah, it was. Okay. So it was based on this guy that we're talking about now then. That's interesting. I'll definitely pull that out and see if I can find it on a streaming service or other means. We'll see how we get on with that. So, Brooker, where can people find you online and what are you up to at the moment?
The best place to find me is on Twitter. I tend to, in the evenings, when I'm sitting watching rubbish TV, I tend to rant and rave about whatever's on TV and angering me. I promise I try and be funny about it. It doesn't always work, but at Brooker411 on Twitter is the best place to find me. Pretty much everything I do gets shared there. I run a video game podcast. I share everything there as well. So
fantastic. Definitely worth checking that out. You can find me on Twitter. My handle is at R Muldrake. That's R-M-U-L-D-R-A-K-E. Obviously, you can find me on the Time Is Now pod as well, and all that information will come at the end credits there. But until next time, this is who we are.
The Time Is Now, a Millennium podcast, was created by Tony Black, who co-produces alongside Kurt North. You can find the show on Twitter at The Time Is Now Pod, and on Facebook if you type in The Time Is Now. Plus, we have a Facebook fan group called The Yellow House, full of active Millennium discussion. The Time Is Now is also part of the We Made This podcast network at We Made This Pod, alongside a range of popular culture shows about TV, film, music, and beyond, including our sister show, The X-Cast, an X-Files podcast. For advance access to The Time Is Now and access to bonus material, consider supporting The X-Cast and We Made This on Patreon at patreon.com/TheXcast. That's patreon.com/TheXcast. You'll find a full range of subscription tiers available. Thanks for listening. Previously on the We Made This Network. Cinemortuary.
So if you're going to get him a birthday present, way too late. Sorry, Dave, I didn't get you a birthday present.
So I'll take one in April.
Okay.
There's some WrestleMania spoilers then, you dick.
So my pick this week is a little present to you, Dave. You've had a hard time with some of our picks, you know, recently. Chris?
He gave us a video game.
Yes, yes.
Sorry, two blokes in their early 30s that can't play a video game. I said that to a room full of people earlier, and they were just like, what the fuck? This is a room full of blokes.
we've got lives. I mean, what do them blokes in the 30s
You're not
do?
Working at the minute.
Well, no, I'm not. No, probably the way it's fucking going, I still won't do it. This episode goes out.
What'd you pick?
Predator 2.
Ah.
Make It So, a Star Trek Picard podcast.
I just think she was awful from day one. She didn't get any better. And, I mean, her quite naff death as well, where she has a brief little skirmish with Seven and gets kicked to her death. I was a bit like, well, you know what? I care so little about that character that that's fairly fitting, really.
I thought, that's good. Good that that's out of the way.
Yeah, shrug. That's exactly... Yeah, me too. I was like, thank God for that. Like, let's get on with everything else now. Now she's gone.
We Buy Records.
Well, I've seen some people saying that they're not posting anything out at the moment because they don't want to cause unnecessary burden on the postal service.
A friend of ours is a postal worker, and he said at the end of last week that week just gone... been like Christmas in the sorting office, and not in a good way.
Check out all of these shows and more on the We Made This podcast network.